level of adaptability in the receive mode. Now, what you've done both with the new guide toward Pennsylvania and the guide toward Waltham, Massachusetts, is you peaked it in the receive mode and you transmit it back to him, which means that you're depending on a certain degree of reciprocity of the ionosphere. The ionosphere is known to be quite strongly non-reciprocal. So if the guy in Waltham or the guy in Pennsylvania had the ability to feed back to you the signal strength, you know, by going to the CW mode, you go to key down with 30 watts, so to speak, and you rotate the antenna as L in polarization until what he feeds back to you, the tone gets the strongest. I guarantee it's going to be stronger yet. So even though antenna B seemed to be performing a little bit better than antenna A, even in the direction of Waltham, you only peaked it on receive, and you didn't yet have the feedback to peak it on transmit. You've got another pleasant surprise coming, and it's got to get better. Now, is it going to get a tenth of a dB better, or is it going to get 9 dB better? That's what you're about to find out. And so, again, these guys are going to have to eat some crow, because you are rotating an 80-meter antenna. You're not electronically switching. You're rotating an 80-meter antenna. Yeah, there's a guy in Japan who has a 180-foot-long boom, which is really made out of tower sections, and it's a four-element, fully rotatable 80-meter beam. And yeah, he's got more game than you, and he's got more altitude than you, but he doesn't have as much adaptability. If that antenna of his was rotatable in polarization, he's already got azimuth. He doesn't need a whole lot of elevation, but he can't rotate it in polarization. When he discovers that, my goodness, is he going to have an awakening. And so you've got some more pleasant stuff to come yet. And the problem's going to get stronger and stronger as people find out more and more about what you're doing. And as you start writing that article, you're going to get a lot of flack, because it's beyond any reasonable common sense until you dig deep enough into what is happening with the plasma of ionosphere. The ionosphere is a plasma. That means it is a ionized layer of material which is partially conductive. Some of those electrons and some of those nucleuses of those atoms have been disassociated by solar radiation, Van Allen belt and whatever, and there is an Earth magnetic field mixed into it. And so whenever you've got a plasma which is giving you what we call ionospheric reflection, it's more complicated than that, but I'm going to call it that, ionospheric reflection with the presence of a magnetic field, it is giving Faraday rotation. And when you transmit from east to west, you get one Faraday rotation. When you transmit from west to east, you get another Faraday rotation. So you've got another pleasant surprise coming when you talk these guys into feeding it back to you by crossbanding or feeding it back to you on a telephone. You've got their attention. I think at least one of those guys is going to be willing to make a phone call, feed it back to you while you rotate during transmission. It's going to be fun. K2KEY. You've got a lot of fun coming. K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, I guess any further really legitimate experiments are going to have to wait, because the noise level is getting really horrendous now on 75-80 meters, because as we get into the summer months with all this lightning activities all over the country, it seems to be a constant banging along, constant static that's, you snaps constantly, because especially down through the south, I believe that Florida, they said, is the lightning capital of the United States right now. It has the most strikes in any period of time than anywhere else. So we're getting quite a bit of it. At the point now at night, you can't really even hold a decent QSO because you miss a lot of words, and even at the kilowatt level, it's can be rough going a certain night at this time of the year. 80 meters is not the greatest band, like I say, during the summer months. Yeah, it is the band that is usually open at night, and it is also a band that takes a lot of load, especially next week with field day, because come nighttime right now, it's possible we'll get some little openings. We did have some openings this past week on 20 meters because on Monday night I was very surprised. We had a club meeting, and at Floyd Bennett, I turned on the HF radio on 20 meters, and that was around 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. We were working very well into Europe. And in fact, even after the meeting on the way home on Belt Parkway, we were working into Asia. So that was very unusual, very surprising. But for the most part, field day next week, the 80-40 meter bands will be the two heavy bands. And I'm sure there'll be some 6 meter activity too, and 6 and 2 meter activity. But look for most of the activity on 80 and 40, unless there's some openings on 20 at night. But during the daytime, I'm sure there'll be a lot of activity also on 20. Let's see. Next question. Okay, you ready for another one?
Fire away. And by the way, I know that when field day next week, you might want to invite people who want to see what ham radio is like, because there may be some people out there that find us on scanners or haven't gotten their license yet or haven't gotten as involved as they want to be. So seeing your field day operation at Floyd Bennett Field could be a lot of fun. I think there are multiple choices as to how you set up a field day. I'm going to guess that maybe the Kings County Radio Club starts at roughly noontime doing the setup, and I think the actual contest begins Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. So give me some corrections on that. I think there's another option where you can, with a different set of points, set up either earlier in the day or start setting up the day before. So you might want to give us a couple of words on that. And I presume that guests who want to see a significant radio operation would like to visit you. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Now, we've been talking about that all week long, advertising it and whatnot. This is K2KEY, and we will be at the KCRC field day operation at Floyd Bennett Airport here in Brooklyn. And it will start, we'll start setting up at around 9 o'clock in the morning. We'll be putting up the antennas around 9 o'clock in the morning and getting the room ready. And official starting time here is 2 o'clock. Most of the country will be starting around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. California, because, you know, they'll be, when we're starting at 9 o'clock, it'll be, you know, pitch dark out there. It'll be night, real nighttime. They give them, I believe, an extra hour of operating. They can start like an hour basically later and continue. I believe that's only for the West Coast because of a different time situation. But, yes, all is welcome. There's plenty of free parking. We've got nice bathrooms, especially for both ladies and gentlemen. And, you know, if you want to bring the kids or wife, the kids, you know, it's a comfortable place. We're not out in the field. They call it field day. A lot of people get that misnomer that we're, you know, out in the boondocks. They're out in the, with the flies and the mosquitoes and everything else and the bugs. But, no, we're not in that situation. We're in a very comfortable place. And it's an interesting event, and we also let people that come to visit, that they would like to try to get on here and see what this amateur radio is like. Well, more the merrier, as they say. Everybody's welcome. Let's see. What else were we going to talk? Oh, yes. Somebody sent me here. This thing is pretty complicated. He's looking into purchasing a log periodic. Very fascinated by a log periodic antenna, but boy, he says each one gives a different reference to a dipole, and he says I'm trying to discern which one. Like, for instance, he says I give one. He says, let's see. He says they seem to be basically broadband multi-element unidirectional end fire arrays. Yeah. One says 8 dB forward gain. The other one says 14 dB forward gain. Same number of elements, basically faithful. And then it says, let's see, the front-to-back ratio on one is 10 dB, while the other one is 14 dB, while the side attenuation on one is 15 dB, and the other one's 25 dB. He goes on. He says, and then, let's see, then they tell them about in the H-plane and the vertical radiation, all this stuff. I don't know how really to explain this log periodic, what to look for in a log periodic, Dick. This one, let's see, what is the thing? Oh, the log periodic, he says, I'm looking at go from 40 to 10 meters. And he says, and, I'd like to know, give me a guideline, what do I look for? I guess this is your department, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, this one's not going to be too easy. 40 through 10 meters, a 40-meter log periodic. If it's not using loading coils, the longest element is going to be in the vicinity of 65 feet long. Very few of us are willing to mount an antenna where an element that can be part of the antenna and the whole thing rotates. Most people buy a log periodic and intend to rotate it. Although there's ways you can build a so-called wire log periodic. In other words, you have catenary wires strung between the four trees, so to speak, and this whole thing is aimed in one direction as a whole bunch of complicated wires. That's one way to build a log periodic. Log periodics have, I think it's called the T factor, the taper factor. How fast is a taper? How many elements? Rarely do they get beyond 8 dB of gain over isotropic. When some of these manufacturers claim, and by the way, isotropic is usually 2.1 dB, a higher number than over dipole. A number of companies, and I'm trying to think of the name of the one I'm thinking of now that we ran across last week. A high-quality antenna company built something called the K9, I think it is. Why can't I think of the name of that company? If somebody remembers the name of the company, just break in and tell me. Anyhow, when you look at their gain numbers, they are coming up with gain numbers including ground reflection, which is both good and bad, but as long as they tell you what they're doing, it makes some sense. At frequencies like 40 meters, if your eyes operated at 40 meters and you stood up at your antenna and looked at the horizon, yes, you'd see the horizon. Above that, you'd see the ionosphere. Below the horizon, what your normal eyesight sees is grass and dirt, trees, and houses and buildings and whatever. To a 40-meter signal, most of that jazz is a mirror because the wavelength is so big, the fine details of grass and shrubs and whatever, it doesn't see. It sees that ground as a mirror. As such, a substantial portion of a horizontally polarized signal striking the ground out in front of your antenna some distance also reflects off that ground as a mirror. Therefore, there's a real antenna above the ground, there's a mirror image of your antenna below the ground, and they're both separated from the ground surface by roughly the same number. But because the horizontally polarized signal experiences very close to 180 degrees of phase reversal on reflection, that's a fancy way of saying that your above ground antenna and your mirror image below ground antenna are operating out of phase with each other. That puts a null on the horizon, and some number of degrees above the horizon, like 20 or 30 degrees typically, depending on altitude, in wavelengths, the extra path length from the below ground antenna to that point in the sky, 30 degrees up, versus the direct path from your real antenna above the ground to that point 30 degrees up, that extra path length gives you an extra 180 degrees of phase shift, and now the signals come back in phase again. That's 30 degrees above the ground. That's your first elevation lobe, which is dependent on how high the antenna is above the Earth. And in some cases, there's another lobe 60 or 70 degrees up. Again, there's chapters in the ARL antenna book that do cover this. And so you are really choosing the elevation takeoff angle. When you choose the elevation, how many feet above ground you're mounting that antenna. So assuming now that the 30 degree, in my example, elevation angle, the peak of beam and elevation at 30 degrees is a desirable one to bounce off the ionosphere to your particular friend at some particular range today, today's date of the ionosphere, that ground bounce in that situation can give you up to 6 decibels of gain. You're getting the real signal direct, the bounce signal by the indirect path from the virtual antenna below ground, and the way antenna signals work. Common sense would lead you to believe you add the powers. If I've got 100 watts of real and 100 watts of reflected, you think you've got 200 watts out there at the 30-degree elevation angle of my example. Good common sense, but it's not true. If the ground reflectivity was perfect, you add the voltage, not the power. In this case, when it comes to free space signals, you add voltages. So you add the voltage from the real antenna, you add the voltage from the reflected signal, which is the virtual antenna, and twice voltage is a 4-to-1 power increase, which is a 6-decibel increase. So you could get as many as 6 decibels of increase. Notice that would make an 8 dB antenna 14 dB. 8 dB plus 6 dB is 14. So a couple of the antenna manufacturers are including the most desirable ground bounce signal when they tell you the realized gain in your particular backyard. As long as they tell you what they're doing, you can now rate the two. An unscrupulous manufacturer would call his antenna 14 dB of gain, and a more truthful guy would call it 8, and if both are not telling you what's going on, it's a little bit difficult to judge. When it comes to an 8 element, we'll say, log periodic antenna. I said 8 element. 8 dB. An 8 dB log periodic antenna of the exact same number of elements. Can some guy use a gold dust, fairy dust, kryptonite, or whatever in his antenna, and he's really got 6 dB more gain in an anechoic chamber? No way in hell. The difference in gain between these antennas probably is small. The difference in performance as far as weatherproofing is concerned. Would one of them survive a Hurricane Gloria and the other one gets blown over by a 40-mile-an-hour wind? That may be more important. And the dollars you have to spend and how many pounds it weighs and how many square foot of wind load and is your tower weighted for that wind load? These are some of the more important factors. When it comes to forward gain, I think there's not as much difference as you think. When it comes to front-to-back ratio, I think there's not as much as you think. When it comes to front-to-side ratio, there's not as much difference as you think. One guy may tell you he's got 15 dB downside load, another guy has got 25 dB downside load. By the way, the total amount of energy put into the side lobes, being 15 dB down or 25 dB down, the total amount of energy there is so darn small that it can't make even a tenth of a dB of difference in forward gain. So it's a nice academic thing to know. Every antenna has side lobe nulls. If you carefully tune in azimuth and elevation, you can find a side lobe null as deep as you want to measure. It's just a matter of choosing that exact sharp little point in space. When you look at the nulls, they're a very sharp knife edge-like thing of amplitude versus angle, whereas peaks are always very broad. So the peak of the main lobe is broad, and that narrow notch of the front-to-back ratio, or that narrow notch of the side lobe, is so narrow that we're really talking about academics here. And so don't be sucked up by that one. Front-to-back could be important to you if you think you're going to have some QR Mary coming into the back of the antenna from Pennsylvania when you aimed at, we'll say, Africa. But even that, you could make some minor modifications to the antenna to tune that a little bit better if you wanted to, with no sacrifice in forward gain. So most of what you're reading, I think, is advertising hyperbole, and so when they include ground gain in there, the numbers get a little bit crazy. And is this a scrupulous versus an unscrupulous thing to do? Well, let me give you another example. Some antennas have got a 1.5 worst case standing wave ratio, some got a 1.3. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is worst case half a dB of loss. A 1.5 standing wave ratio is well under a quarter of a dB of worst case loss. So, Viswire versus gain, very minor factor. However, the IEEE, in their definition, a dictionary definition of antenna terms, describes the fact that when you're using their testing procedures, gain is that phenomena of an antenna that you measure after you have corrected for standing wave ratio. whether you use an antenna tuner, an antenna matchbox, an impedance matching network, or correct the antenna itself. Doesn't matter. VISWAR is not part of the gain measurement by the IEEE standard. So if I carry that philosophy one step forward, I would say ground bounce is not part of the antenna measurement. Because if you truly want to measure what the antenna does, irrespective of the environment, because no two guys have got the exact same environment, if you really want to measure antenna gain, I think you should not be including ground bounce. However, if you've got a condition in your backyard that is somewhat similar to the measurement they made in their antenna testing range, and you're really going to be getting that ground bounce gain, as long as they tell you what it is, it's a nice piece of information. It'd be nice if they gave you both figures, true antenna gain of the antenna in a theoretical anechoic, meaning non-echo, non-reflective environment, and then give you a second line. This is the gain that we think you'll get if you have good ground bounce conditions in your environment. To give you both and properly describe it, that would be the best of all worlds. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, goes on to write, yes, I'm sure that the gentleman is listening. I don't know where he's going to put, where he's planning on putting this thing, because this is quite a piece of hardware. Let's see, he asked me also, he says, the company mentions that they have a 13-element array on a 54-foot boom. And they said this required for a, this is the minimum they said that is required for a log periodic of this type. However, they would suggest if you would like to have a much better antenna that we also have a version of this with 17 elements. Jeez. They estimate that this antenna, they said, has a 36-degree bandwidth, or aperture, I guess, width. I guess that's what you go by. Let's see, what is he mentioning about this antenna? He gives me a whole bunch of things about this antenna, and says that the average gain is approximately 8 dB. And, oh my God, these antennas somebody's mentioning here, these are monstrosities, these are monsters. I don't know where you put such things, but does that sound practical to 13 elements? Is the, as they said, the minimum required for this log periodic? Oh, to cover a single octave, whatever that means, Dick, over.
Yeah, that's interesting. If it covers a single octave, does it mean it covers 80 and 40, or other questions, 40 and 20, or 20 and 10? Those are an octave, 2-to-1 frequency range. Octave means 2-to-1. And if a guy doesn't have a fair amount of experience with simple dipole antennas and HF operation before launching into the 13-element job with 54 feet of boom, if the person happens to be well-heeled, economically well-off, or what do we usually say along these lines, quite affluent, and doesn't worry about spending the money, yes, it could be fun to just jump in with both feet and buy one of these super big antennas. It's very similar to what happens when a person decides to get into astronomy. I was at a meeting on Thursday in which one of the guys I work with was describing the fact that he went and bought a $4,500 telescope as his very first telescope. He reached a certain age, he decided that he deserves it, and so he went and spent that much of the family funds, $4,500. And he admits that he used the telescope, it's an 11-inch Cassegrain, Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. I think it's a 90-pound piece of hardware. He used it quite a few times during the first months, and that was 2 or 3 years ago, and it's been gathering dust ever since. You read Sky and Telescope magazine, they've got a beautiful section, or if you go to the Sky and Telescope website, and what should my first telescope be? There's a series of articles And they tell you to start off with binoculars and something small to find out if you really like the hobby. To go out and spend great big bucks and buy the biggest and best may not be practical until you're sure that you really like the hobby. And you can't tell until you've gone to some meetings of people and really done some work with it for probably 6 months or a year. So ham radio has a similar characteristic to it. In both cases, you're talking about relatively high technology. You and I, Mel, could go out and buy a top-of-the-line 80 through 10 meter transceiver that runs quite a few hundred watts. It's got all kinds of digital signal processing and adaptive filtering. It's got adaptive notching. It's got IF shifting. It's got all kinds of scanning modes. It's got cross-banding capability. It can transmit on band A while listening on band B, and so on. We can easily spend $5,000 for a top-of-the-line rig. I could easily spend a couple $1,000s for a top-of-the-line antenna. I could easily spend $5,000 for a top-of-the-line crank-up tower, and so on. I could easily jump into this hobby and spend $20,000 or $25,000. If I'm a very affluent person, and $25,000 is just the outside thin foliage on your roll of money, maybe go for it. But for the rest of us working people, that's not practical. To work your way up to that and convince yourself after a couple of years of using considerably more conservative equipment and decide that, yeah, this is the hobby I've been looking for all my life, and now I want to really jump in. It makes some sense. But to put both feet into that particular ocean immediately, I recommend going a little bit slow. Because although your enthusiasm is there today, Is it going to be that level of enthusiasm a year from now? It's an interesting question. So, and log periodics are not popular among ham radio operators. The idea of an antenna that tunes continuously with, I mean, you buy a multi-band trap dipole-like antenna, and on each of the ham bands, it behaves amazingly, moderately well. In between the ham bands, it probably behaves, standing wave ratio-wise, rather poorly. And to have a log periodic, which does, with good design, tune continuously. So you can do listening to shortwave frequencies on the in-between ham bands. Well, the average ham radio operator doesn't care about that. He throws up a long wire antenna when it comes to shortwave listening, and he puts it into an antenna tuner. For his ham radio operations, he really cares about what the antenna does in the individual ham bands. So, for that reason, among other reasons, I think log periodics are very rarely used in the HF ham radio environment. The number of guys in the United States that have got them, I think you can count them on two hands. Whereas when it comes to ham band only antennas, that's what 99% of us are using. K2KEY, K2RIW, all of that was opinion.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Now I know which one this is. Yes, I saw this thing on QRZ. I always sometimes just scan down the list of the equipment, you know, that people want to sell or trade. And I saw an antenna listed there as that log and tower and all, and I went to, you know, to look at it on QRZ, and this guy is K1ND. Got this thing for sale with a tower, and he wants $13,000 for it. He says he'll take it down, and you transport it. But he wants, like I say, I guess it may have been a commercial piece of it. I know it was a company that a company called Defense Communications Engineering that originally built this thing. And like I say, he wants to sell his K1ND. He wants to sell this thing for $13,000. I don't know what the original cost on it was, but I can imagine it was quite something. There's a lot of material there, a lot of weight. So if you have the room for it, no, what can I say? Go for it. it's no doubt will be a well working piece of hardware. And it's just that to me, it's quite an undertaking. I guess you got to be very dedicated to amateur radio. But I know there are people. Listen, I've seen some really big arrays. I remember one out in the island. I went out to see, right, I guess out your way somewhere, was that big Telrex Christmas tree array, which also went for a very, very big chunk of cash. And, you know, it was very impressive. I really got impressed by that. Was this thing that was quite an antenna. I don't know if it's still there, but it was worth seeing. I mean, it was worth the trip. So what can I say, Dick? I can say, if you've got the buck, I guess, it sounds like it could be quite a piece of hardware, but boy, sounds like a tremendous undertaking. A little out of my class, I'm sure. Let's see, what else? I guess, let's see, do I have anything else? What else was I reading here? Alright, well, unless you want to make some other comments, and I'll look through some others, over.
Well, I think we've pretty much given our opinions on this one, Mel. Why don't you go to your next email that you think is a little bit on the universal side, where other people can enjoy the answer.
I kind of looking for antenna questions, basically. A lot of this stuff, I could say, is either repeats of basically what we've discussed before. It's no use really, you know, rehashing that. You can all find that on our amateurradio.tv.com online, and if you want to listen to any of these different talks that we've had on a number of these subjects, you'll find what you're looking for. Let's see. Here's another one. Well, that's it. He says, I've seen log periodic. Jeez, look at this. This is funny. I've used log periodic Vs and rhombics and monopoles in Antarctica when I was stationed there. And I wonder, I still keep in contact with Antarctica. And I'd like to design something like a four-element phased array for 40 meters, which seems to be basically the best band to get to contact Antarctica on right now. Let's see. Halfway, very broad. He says, I'm looking for like a 60-degree beam width, because this way I can reject some of the QRM and on and on. What do you think is practical to put together something like a four-element phased array for 40 meters? Is this doable? I've got at least an acre of land in back of my house. I don't know. You want to answer this, Dick? Over.
Yes, I do. By the way, let me repeat the email address where you can listen to approximately a year's worth now of TechNet. And there is no .com on there. A lot of people make a mistake. www.amateurradio, all one word, with double R between amateur and radio. Amateur ends with R and radio begins with R. amateurradio.tv. That's it. amateurradio.tv. There is no .net or .com or .org after that. amateurradio.tv. And you'll see a very nice page, and you can see the section for the TechNet. And there's more than one TechNet now. There's another one at the Bauer Group has another TechNet. Bergenfield Amateur Radio Club, or Amateur Radio Association, I guess it is. They also have a TechNet that meets on Thursday night, I think it is. And so you can listen to their TechNet, and you can listen to our TechNet. And it takes a little bit of there's a little bit of a learning curve to use the website. When you click on the date, you'll see the rundown of what got discussed during each, let's say, 5-minute period of time. And then it tells you what's in reel number one, reel number two, reel number three, and reel number four. Each reel is roughly an hour's worth. And so you then go back out by backing out of the website, one step, so to speak, and then you can click on the individual reel and then start listening to the actual audio itself. Now, when it comes to talking to Antarctica, if 40 meters is the band, and you're trying to get as much signal into Antarctica as possible, you can do that with a kilowatt. But when it comes to listening to Antarctica, yes, you're going to want as much antenna gain as possible, because that's really down the road a piece. That's a long haul. And it would be nice if the antenna was tunable in front-to-back ratio, because there are a few occasions when the long pad to Antarctica will sound better than the short pad. In other words, instead of going directly south, Antarctica is almost due south of us. You can either go due south or due north. Go due north, you go over the North Pole and back down the other side of the Earth. Depending where the terminator line is, night and day situations, one path may be better than the other. But let's assume now for the time being, the short path is the good one. And I want to get as much 40 dB gain as I can possibly do it. I would be hard-pressed to decide which is better between a bunch of vertical monopoles used as a phased array or as a wire Yagi antenna. Since Antarctica is rather fixed in direction, almost due south of us, you'd want to develop as much gain as possible due south. You choose the right chapter of the antenna handbook, you will find what I call a wire Yagi antenna. In other words, as long as you've got four support poles, four trees, in approximately the right location, and you hook up ropes between them. This is a setup you hook up all correctly, you wire it all together on the ground, and then haul it up to the altitude by, let's say, a pulley on each one of the four trees. But the outer set of ropes constitute a catenary, where there are individual elements of the Yagi strung between them. And if the rope itself is a non-conducting material, you may not even use egg insulators. But I think they do use, most of these design egg insulators, and you could make a 2, 3, or 4, or maybe even a 5 element 80 meter beam, all out of ropes and wires. And the raw materials that go into it is probably $100. And a lot of rigmarole with the ropes and pulleys on the trees, but so that could give you a lot of gain at a reasonable altitude in the desired direction. I would even consider the possibility of going in the direction of the tunable antenna. I can't even think of the model number of that thing now. Where the stepper IR. Take a look at the stepper IR. He happens to have a 40-meter version. It's pricey. And I'm not telling you to build it. But recognize the fact that as you tune the element lengths, you can make the antenna fire forward with a lot of gain, or backward with a medium amount of gain. So therefore, after this wire Yagi antenna is working pretty nicely, you can consider the possibility of putting relays in the wires, which open and close, making the length of the wires longer and shorter, so that you either make a forward-firing Yagi or a reverse-firing Yagi, by commanding these relays in the wire to change the length. A little bit elaborate, but not, definitely doable. And that gives you the possibility of going long path or false short path. By the same token, vertical monopoles can also do that for you. Now the vertical monopoles, if you did them on 40 meters, which means each one of them is going to be 32 feet high with a whole elaborate set of ground planes, that's one approach on each one of the monopoles. And you feed them as a phased array, multiple feed lines, and you feed the right power ratio and the right phase angle to each of the antennas, and that steers the beam either down south toward Antarctica or due north for the long path over the North Pole. But the vertical monopoles with all those wires for those ground planes down low to the ground may not be the best approach. If you've got at least two trees that are tall enough, you could hang through a bunch of vertical wires, each a half wavelength long. And they hang from a horizontal piece of rope between two tall trees as a horizontal catenary of rope. If you take a look at a suspension bridge, those cables that hold up the suspension suspension bridge are called a catenary. And those individual vertical risers that hold up the bed of the road of the suspension bridge, each of those could be a vertical element of a Yagi. I think you see the way it could be built. And so, with just ropes and wires, you and I could develop a lot of vertically polarized gain, or a lot of horizontally polarized gain, or both. And so without a great big investment, once you understand the technology, in your acre or backyard, you could make a tremendous amount of gain. It wouldn't be rotatable, but it doesn't have to be. And so when you make these elements out of wire held up to the right location with ropes, your first question is going to be, gee, if I built it as a real Yagi, where the elements would be 2-inch diameter tubing, and instead I'm using a piece of 14-gauge wire, will the gain be the same? The answer is yes. Will the efficiency be the same? The answer is yes. And so what are you gaining with a 2-inch diameter piece of tubing? A lot of physical strength if it's a rotatable array, a rotatable Yagi. But this isn't within the cost constraints that I think the average guy is going to work with a high gain antenna at 40 meters. It doesn't have to be rotatable. So these catenary-like antennas, you'd be amazed how many commercial antennas have been set up to do that when it comes to talking to aircraft as they cross the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean. Your AirLink antennas use techniques just like that. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I read a little further on. This book of thing was quite long. And he says, when I was stationed at McMurdo, and McMurdo Station, the Navy had installed under a contract with Collins at the time a log periodic on a 100-foot tower. And we had as our backup antenna, where is it? Oh, here. He shows a little sketch of it. The backup antenna was 40-meter phased array antennas that were made with 14 AVQ verticals. This was their backup because, he says, of the high wind situation there, it destroyed temporarily, put the big log out of commission, and they were running on this 14 AVQ, and he says that they were able to maintain quite good communication. They think that the log periodic had only about a 3 dB advantage over the phased array. And I'd like to know, can if I duplicate this phased array situation, do you think that I will get, it'll cost me very little to put up a phased array? Do you think, no, that's what it was. Do you think this is the best way to go overall for a gain? He says, I would like to see if I can achieve the same gain of almost 9 dB that we had in McMurdo. I don't know how to answer this, take over.
Yeah, you can only get 9 dB of gain out of either 4 or 5 elements of a Yagi-like structure. 3 elements can get you 6 dB over isotropic. 4 or 5 elements will get you 9 dB over isotropic. And so 4 or 5 elements on 40 meters as a rope Yagi, either horizontally polarized or vertically polarized, is rather doable as long as you've got some high supports to hold this thing all up. The horizontal is going to require 4 supports. The vertical only requires 2 supports. And those 2 supports would have to be more than 70 feet tall in order to suspend these elements that are 65 feet long for half wave. And I do recommend half wave elements.
Yeah.
And maybe you could use some loading coils in there if you absolutely positively had to make it a little bit shorter. And you could make that all work. So there's been quite a bit of history of that kind of an antenna. And now, which is the best? answer is yes. Depending on the state of the ionosphere, some days the horizontal will work better, some days the vertical will work better. 40 meters has a lot of Faraday rotation of the ionosphere, and to go between here and McMurdo Bay, I'm sure there's at least 3 or 4 bounces off of the ionosphere to do it. And you're getting all kinds of Faraday rotation on each individual bounce. So there's a lot of variables involved. And if you did have a horizontal antenna and a vertical antenna, boy, that would be fun to flip back and forth between the two. Even to feed them in combinations so that you generate circular polarization. Some one of those combinations on each day of the week is going to have the best reliability, the least amount of fades, the best signal-to-noise ratio, the least amount of pickup of QRM, and so on. I don't recommend a normal affluent amateur have a rotatable log periodic in his backyard on 40 meters. For a person who's retired and has a lot of money to spend, that could be fun. But for us working people, I'm not convinced that's practical. But a fixed direction, Yagi-like structure with ropes and wires, catenaries, either horizontally or vertically polarized, or both, I think it's going to give you the biggest bang for the dollar. You and I have been hearing lots of reports now of guys who have a simple half-wave dipole up in the trees, and they build or buy one of these whiz-bang, fancy-looking vertical quarter-wave ground plane antennas that have got all kinds of fancy coils and gold plating and shiny aluminum and requires a whole network of ground plane radios, and they do all the installation in the backyard, and they get weaker performance than that simple $4 dipole that's strung up in the trees. Some of that is altitude of takeoff angle. Some of that is horizontal versus vertical polarization. Some of that is local obstructions that you're clearing a little bit better with the extra altitude. Some of it is whether or not the Faraday favors horizontal or vertical today. I may have said that already. I'm not a strong advocate of vertical quarter-wave ground plane antennas. They're very fancy looking. The more expensive ones cover quite a number of bands simultaneously. And so when you're looking at specs on that page, and if you're somewhat ignoring the dollars, it looks like a really great antenna. I'm not convinced you get your money's worth. I'd much rather see a guy put up a multi-band trap dipole, a fan dipole, or multiple dipoles, one east-west and one north-south. One vertically polarized, one horizontally polarized. Simple dipole antennas are going to give you an awful lot of performance for not a great number of dollars. You may think that it's undesirable to fill up your backyard with wire. I heard Jerry the other day say that, if you put all those wires in your backyard, it's going to look like the back of a plumbing shop. I disagree. Most people do not see wire. Ask all the people who visit your house, how many wires are on the utility poles in front of your house? They can't tell you. They don't see them. Ask them, what is the color of the shingles on your house? They can't tell you because they don't look up in the air. So above the roof of your house, you can string a large number of wires before anybody is even going to notice it. That's an opinion. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, as I understand this now, it's like I say, this is a long story here. In McMurdo, they had a log periodic on a 100-foot tower. And he got a hold of this, that the high gain has the phase array setup that you can by 4 high gain 14 ABQ trapped vertical. And they give you a layout that supposedly, for instance, if you want to use them like this particular situation, a layout for a 40 meter phased array using these high gain verticals. And they said that the gain of this antenna is somewhere around 9 dB. Four verticals laid out, Let's see, they got the verticals laid out in a pattern. We are in the direction of propagation. On that side is a quarter wavelength, and the spacing is a half wavelength. So, is this practical? Well, I guess it's practical. Will it give you a gain of nearly 9 dB? Will it be better than putting up some kind of wire type of beams or whatever? I don't know, but the idea, of course, he likes it because it does not, he has no support, high support, and very level ground, and he says the radio pattern is very doable. Well, the radio pattern that they suggest, a quarter wavelength radio, 34 and a half feet for each vertical, and they give you the feed line and the whole thing. I know I've seen this so-called mention before, Dick, but he would like to know, he says, does that sound like it's more or less in the ballpark figures? I guess it must have been tested, Dick, over.
That broadside array or end-fire array of four quarter wave vertical ground plane radials with all the radials, can it give you 9 dB over isotropic? Absolutely. Can do that. That's what the pattern is giving you. But now, what's the real on-the-air performance? Before launching into the four antennas, the four quarter wave ground plane radials with all of those radials, quarter wave ground plane antenna, my strongest recommendation is you put up one of those and compare it against one dipole at some reasonable altitude. Put up even with temporary push-up telescoping tubing act as antenna supports. Compare one dipole in your backyard to one ground plane before you launch into four of them. If you find, like I think you're going to find, and you've gotten quite a few pieces of email on this, Mel, where that dipole quite often behaves better than that fancy ground plane. And if you find that to be true, in your direction, your backyard, then it's time to use ropes and wires and catenaries and string things in the air. Even if you have to put up the supports to hold it, guide to, what was it now, Telrex, among other companies, used to make telescoping tubing with guide ropes, let's call it. You push it up from the bottom, and I think they went either 30 or 40 feet in the air. And so, that's an approach. I'm of the belief that the four ground planes as a phased array will work, but I'm not convinced that you're going to get the full cost effectiveness, let's say. The dollars invested, the labor invested, and the performance may not be proportional to what the wires and ropes in the air are able to do for you. Now, considering what you're discovering, Mel, with your tunable loop antenna, my goodness, you haven't yet built a 40-meter version. But boy, that would be tempting, though, to set up some simple motors, because your antenna is so darn compact. Even if you want some altitude and you want to have it not in the shack with you because you want to radiate 1,500 watts into it, to put it on a pole in the backyard with some not-too-elaborate motors that tilted in as, L, and polarization, which is an adaptable antenna. An interesting question is, would that adaptable antenna come up to the performance of a four-element Yagi made out of ropes and wires? I think the four-element Yagi is going to be ahead, but not by a huge amount when you include the adaptability. K2KEY, are you about to build a four-element job? I mean, a 40-meter job. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, Dick. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I thought, you know, different things and all, and I can say get involved with a lot of things, so, you know, it's hard to put a lot of effort into one thing at a time, you know. He's supposed to be retired, but doesn't seem to really work out that well at times. Things are sort of interfere with those terrific ideas, unfortunately. Alright, so I guess this 14ABQ system, yeah, I guess he could also, he says that the added advantages would be, he says I would also get 20, 15, and 10 meters on that antenna, which is true, because that's basically those 14ABQ high gain verticals, trapped verticals, were basically multi-band verticals, and they're very popular, and I guess with the proper installation, you really got to really observe the installation with the radial. You really got to do that radial, go through that bit with that radial, lay out all those radials, and they do, they ask for quite a number of radials to really make the system work for each one of the verticals. I believe they're looking for at least 36 radials per antenna, per vertical, and that's four of them, so you got quite a number of pieces of wire to lay down. But I guess it will, it could be effective enough for what he wants to do. You know, it's so hard to give a definite what if situation, and everybody's, you know, situation being different. Alright, I think we'll let that one sit. I could say it's a couple of pages of it. You know, I got another one here. Oh, jeez, long thing I went through here. It's right up your alley. I'm sure you get a tickle out of this one, over.
Sent to RRA Mobile with a couple of questions. Okay, Mr. RRA, start over with your name, sir. And then fire your questions. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW. And 2RRA Mobile, the name is Eric. Echo Romeo India Charlie. We are Stroke Mobile, so good evening to you and all. I listen to you just about every single Sunday. So, a couple of questions. Catching, actually coming into the middle of the lake, and catching what I have been catching. I hear a lot about DBI. First question. When you're looking into gain and an antenna, correct me if I'm wrong, when in terms of DBI, decibel of isotropic, is that not a theoretical gain on an antenna? When you want to look at an antenna, you want to look at DBD gain? Let's start off with that, over.
Which one do you want to look at, DBI or DBD is what I think you're asking, Eric. And the answer is yes. As long as you're smart enough, either one can do. A light bulb in the middle of a spherical room is an isotropic kind of an antenna. If I made the room the right diameter so it has 100 square feet of area on the inside, and if my light bulb is 100 watts and it's smearing its energy equally around that spherical room, 100 watts into 100 square feet means that each square foot gets 1 watt of power. 1 watt per square foot would be the power flux density I would experience from that light bulb at the surface of that spherical room. So isotropic, as you can see, mathematically is a nice reference point, and you can compare all antennas to it. Yes, you're right. An isotropic antenna doesn't exist. There are a couple of EH-like antennas that come close, but it doesn't really exist. But since a dipole is well documented by Krauss's book on antennas as having 2.14 decibels over isotropic. Dipole is 2.14 dB over ISO. That allows you to take somebody's claim for gain, and if he tells you it's ISO, you can subtract 2.14, and you know the gain over dipole. Or conversely, if he gives you gain in dipole, you can add 2.14 if you want to make it ISO, so you can compare brand A to brand B. So they're both good techniques, and now that you know that there's 2.14 between them, you can do the conversion. Now back to you, Eric.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was made clear earlier because, like I said, it came in late. But I wanted to see if